Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. How are the country's banks faring? The results of the so-called stress tests on banks are due to be announced this Thursday. The question is, how many banks will need more government money? But President Obama indicated over the weekend that that's only the beginning of a stream of questions. What about the non-banking sector that provides half the country's credit? And should traditional banks be allowed to get into risky businesses like bundling and selling mortgages? Well, the president made those comments in an extensive sit-down interview with our first guest, New York Times economics columnist David Leonhardt. And David, his Sunday Times article can be found at our website, hereandnow.org. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get to the stress test first, because you write today that the banks are healthier than investors feared, that the needs may be able to be taken care of through already approved bailout money. And one way or another, the stress tests have the potential to be a turning point in this financial crisis. How so?
Well, the notion that the banks are healthier than investors fear, I think we don't know that yet. But that's certainly the case that the Obama administration and the Federal Reserve are going to make when they release the stress tests later this week. It's a reasonable case because we've seen some improvement in the credit markets lately. I think a number of these banks are actually in okay shape. I think many of them probably are. And to me, in many ways, the most compelling part of this argument is the idea that banks often look insolvent during downturns. If you look back in other crises, and not just the Great Depression, but the early 80s and early 90s, at the depth of downturns, banks often look insolvent because the market prices of their assets are really low. That doesn't mean they can't recover. And I think that's what we're going to see the administration argue. Not in every case. In a few cases, they're going to say the banks, in fact, are so sick that they do need more government help. But they're going to try to basically separate out the healthier ones from the sicker ones and make people confident enough to invest in the healthier ones.
Well, and how are they going to earn the trust of Americans in the results of the test? There are critics who say banks are being allowed to project too rosy a view because of their ability to value their assets at what they may be worth down the road rather than what they are worth. And there are critics who are saying the test itself isn't based on a gloomy enough forecast. You write about this, that there's a sense that the banks aren't being tested for how bad the economy is going to be. In other words, that the administration is taking too rosy a view.
I think it's a reasonable, somewhat pessimistic forecast about what's going to happen over the next 2 years. And within that, it does actually seem like it has pretty pessimistic forecasts about loan default rates. Jan Hatzius, an economist at Goldman Sachs, who was skeptical of these tests initially, said that based on what we know right now, it looks like these are going to be loan default rates that in some cases exceed those during the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. Now, if we get unemployment that goes to 15 or 20%, then these stress tests aren't going to be worth the paper they're written on. All these banks are going to have massive problems. But if we have an unemployment rate at 15 or 20%, we've got a lot of problems.
Right. And again, you quote analysts today who say that, you know, their fears about the stress test may be unfounded, and so that sort of allays some of those fears.
Based on what we know now. Right. I think it's really hard to make an excellent judgment on that until we actually get the tests on Thursday.
Well, and how does the president handle the couple of banks that may not score well? Bank of America and Citigroup are mentioned the most. You write banks that don't do well on the test will be given 6 months to shore up their capital before being required to take government money. But how does the Obama administration persuade investors to invest in a bank, help them get that money, when the bank's been put on probation?
Well, it's not going to be easy, and I think there's a good chance that much of this shortfall won't be made up with private investors. I think it will instead be made up in two other ways. One, you go to the investors who already own a stake in these companies, and you, shall we say, try to woo them, perhaps with twisting their arm a little bit, which the federal government has the ability to do, and get them to renegotiate the terms of those investments. This is what happened back in February with some holders of something called preferred stock at Citigroup. It's a classic strategy for dealing with troubled companies. It's the kind of thing we're seeing now with Chrysler and GM. The details are different. And then the second thing would be you tell these banks they have to shrink. You make them sell assets. You make them shed divisions. And in the course of shrinking, the amount of capital they have then becomes more adequate to fund their operations.
Well, and how far does President Obama go with the banking industry? Let's hear a little bit of what you heard in your sit-down interview with the president. He told you we're looking at a different financial landscape. 25-year-olds on Wall Street may not get the big million-dollar bonuses, and therefore, I think your sentence was buy $100 steaks and drop big tips on waiters. So that, you know, part of the financial world is definitely going to change. But what does he say about other changes? Might we see the return that some are calling for to a day when banks hold your money, maybe sell you a mortgage, but hold on to it, don't get involved in risky bundling and selling of mortgages, and that risk is left to Wall Street?
It's funny, that example about the tips was actually the president's, not mine, and it was one of my
yeah.
favorite things about the interview was how granular he got when talking about people in the economy. It wasn't always just about policy stuff, it was about people. But clearly, with these financial matters, policy is hugely important. And to me, the absolute most important thing that the government can do is insist on higher capital requirements from banks. That sounds technical, but it's actually pretty basic. You basically say, look, you must have more money in reserve to cover your bets if they go bad. You don't pretend that perfect regulators can get the banks not to make bets that go bad, because that goes against human nature and a few centuries worth of financial crises. But you do say, look, if you're going to make these bets, and you are, you have to hold enough capital so that if the bets fail, we don't have to come in and rescue you. And I think one of the really interesting questions is just how the fight between the banks and the administration is going to play out on this. The banks don't like this because it basically means that they make less money. When you take on more debt, when you take on more leverage and hold less capital, you can make higher profits. And so I think this is going to be a really interesting fight.
And the president cited the Canadian model as one where it can work, where banks can be highly regulated, still take the risks that they want to take, but be more highly regulated.
Yes. I think there's been some discussion in various places about the idea that the repeal of Glass-Steagall in the 1990s, a Depression-era law that had separated investment and commercial banking, was somehow responsible for this crisis. And I don't think that's right. I think poor regulation did play a big role in this crisis. I think some of the deregulatory changes played a modest role in creating the groundwork for it. But I don't think the separation of commercial and investment banking played a big role in this. And President Obama obviously holds that view as well. His point was that in Canada, these things aren't separated. Banks are regulated more tightly, but these things aren't separated. And Canadian banks have really done remarkably well relative to the other banks in the world. My favorite statistic on this is that a decade ago, Canada had none of the 50 most valuable banks in the world, according to the Financial Times. My guess is that the same may have been true even 2 or 3 years ago. Today, it has 5 of the 50 most valuable banks in the world.
David, you asked him about the future of work for men in particular. You asked about a scene in his book, Dreams from My Father, after a young Obama witnessed arguments between his grandma and grandpa. His grandpa, a factory worker, his grandma made more money. And Obama talked about seeing a look of rage and dejection on his grandfather's face because of the arguments that would ensue and how diminished his grandfather felt. So what did he tell you about work and men in particular?
I want to be really careful not to suggest that there isn't still sexism in society. Men still make more money. But the gap between men and women's pay has really shrunk. And the number of men who are really struggling in this recession and over the last generation has grown significantly. And I think there's this real question of what is the future of work for men now that manufacturing is shrinking. And I asked him a little bit about that. And we talked about the idea that some of the traditional forms of male work, manufacturing, factory work, really can be updated for a new economy. He loves to cite alternative energy jobs. But I also think it's true that there needs to be a little bit of a shift. And he said, look, I would encourage men to more often be teachers and more often be nurses. And I think we're in this situation where we need to go through something of a transition. The same way we went through a transition from an agricultural to a manufacturing economy, we need to go through a transition from a manufacturing to more of a service economy. And we haven't done very well by men to help them make that transition.
Well, and he, the president pointed out that he's trying to do well by women, passing the Lilly Ledbetter bill, addressing the wage gap, one of the first moves in his administration. Well, I also want to get one last question in here. You had an exchange with the president about whether he's hearing dissenting voices on economic policy. You point out top people in charge of the economy were people who argued passionately against regulation, followers of Robert Rubin, people like Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, Peter Orszag, the budget chief. And, you know, he immediately came back to you and said, not Joe Stieglitz and Paul Krugman, who have been passionate voices from the left, criticizing the president. What did he say about not having those more critical voices in his inner circle?
His argument was that, look, he really does have a range of people. Yes, he has proteges of Robert Rubin, but he also has people who are not. And he mentioned Jared Bernstein and Austin Goolsbee and Christina Romer and Paul Volcker, people who are around him. And that's all fair. I am a little bit surprised that he doesn't have a little bit more diversity of background at the very top of his economic team. The people he has there are excellent, but they also come from a somewhat similar background. And I think when you're dealing with the complexity of issues that they're dealing with, it isn't bad to have just a little bit more intellectual diversity at the very top of the structure. And I'm actually surprised that he doesn't, because when I talked to him during the campaign, it was clear to me that he was very focused on the internal debates during the Clinton administration. He still thinks he's getting that diversity through this larger group of people, and he may well be.
That's New York Times economic columnist David Leonhardt. David, we've been speaking largely about the economy, but what was your favorite part of the interview, if you could just sum it up for us?
I found the discussion of healthcare really to be the most interesting. He talked in very personal terms about the decisions he had been faced with involving the end-of-life care of his grandmother. And he also then talked about the idea that we're going to need to have a really difficult national conversation about how to make some of these choices.
Well, he talked about how everyone knew his grandma Toots was dying, and yet she also needed a hip replacement. And so he became one of those Americans making that decision. Should we do that even though we know she's dying? And they did it.
That's right. And these are incredibly difficult choices. I think the most promising avenue for making good choices and perhaps even not having a healthcare system that is quite so costly and inefficient is to present decisions to people more clearly. Because when decisions are presented to people more clearly, rather than doctors simply recommending the most invasive procedure, many people actually end up choosing the less invasive procedures around end-of-life care.
Well, I love that segment of your interview as well, because the president said, you know, we knew how much it cost, and we wanted to have it done. And it just shows the challenges that his administration is going to face in trying to get people not to have that $20,000 hip replacement for a beloved grandma.
That's right. The question is, what do we do when we're faced with the decision of, you know, extending life for 2 weeks for a cost of $50,000? And he was very honest in saying, look, I would have paid for this no matter what, but most people can't pay for that. And it's going to be really, really hard if as a society we say, look, that $50,000 is something we should be spending on child health. It should be something we should be spending in other ways, because resources are not endless. That is going to be really difficult, however, to tell people that that we can't do absolutely everything in medicine.
New York Times economic columnist David Leonhardt again. His interview with the president will be at our website, hereandnow.org. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, just ahead, Mexico says it will reopen for business. And later, should states work with or against Craigslist in fighting crime? Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now, and let's get a swine flu roundup. More cases have been confirmed in North America, including a second dental student here in the Boston area. And in Europe, Portugal reported its first case. In Mexico, where the H1N1 swine flu outbreak started, officials say they will ease restrictions on public life this week because the virus is on the wane there. But a case in Colombia has become the first confirmed case in South America. And Gregory Hartle of the World Health Organization says the Colombian case is why it's too early to say the rest of the world is waning as well.
We cannot lower our guard. There is the high possibility that this virus will come back, especially in colder periods. Mexico is in the northern hemisphere. We are entering the summer months where normally influenza activity is low. So I think we would want to wait a while before making a definitive decision.
Because Colombia is just beginning its flu season. Well, meantime, Mexico says China's quarantine of 70 Mexican travelers is discrimination, and the Mexican government is chartering a plane to bring its citizens home. But it's not just Mexicans who are quarantined in hospitals and hotels. Eddie Sweeney, a retired policeman on vacation from London, is among more than 300 people isolated in a hotel in Hong Kong after a Mexican traveler there was diagnosed with swine flu.
They check us every day. They check our temperature. And if you go over a certain temperature or have a cough or sneeze, then you're whisked off to hospital for further checks.
So, in sum, worldwide, there are more than 1,000 confirmed cases of the H1N1 virus. Mexico has confirmed nearly 600 cases and at least 26 swine flu deaths. But officials said today that things will start to return to normal on Wednesday when restaurants and cafes will reopen. That's welcome news for a Mexican tourism industry that's losing an estimated $100 million a day because of the H1N1 virus. The BBC's Stephen Gibbs reports.
Well, this is the main entrance to the Teotihuacan pyramids, and it's all shut. In front of me is a big steel gate with a large padlock on it. And beyond that, this incredible site. This is one of the main tourist attractions of all Mexico. Once this was one of the biggest cities in the Americas. The centerpiece is these extraordinary, huge pyramids that completely dominate the landscape here. But there's no one around. There are a few people trying to sell things, and just the odd tourist who clearly hasn't realized that this has all been shut down.
The tourists are very important for Mexico.
Do you think people should be afraid of coming to Mexico still because of the virus?
No, I would come. I'm living here, so I think it's a little overreacted, everything, you know.
But you're wearing a face mask. Is that...
Well, because she forced me, my mother.
I don't think it's that serious, really. There haven't been that many cases. I don't know of anyone who's had flu, so it's probably not true, and they're just scaring people, I think. Tourists love Mexico, so I don't think this would be a good reason for them to stop coming here.
Those on the front line of the collapse of Mexico's tourism industry are the souvenir sellers. Outside the pyramids, all said swine flu was having an immediate effect on their livelihoods.
All of us here in Teotihuacan live off tourism, so it's affecting us a lot. The truth is, we don't have any money saved. We can only eat if we sell something. On a normal Sunday, there can be more than 100,000 people, and today we've seen maybe 150, no more.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Is anyone staying here at the moment? Or?
Well, we have like 6% of the occupancy.
6%?
6%.
Mm-hmm. How many rooms do you have?
712.
Wow. Some foreign visitors might see an upside to all this. Hotels in Mexico City are all nearly empty and are offering big discounts. At the upmarket Camino Real, most of the guests are from the World Health Organization. When do you think people are going to start coming back to hotels like this?
Well, I think about 2 months, in 2 months or more.
But 2 months,
I don't know, yeah, because people is afraid. So you hear in the news and everything, I don't think people want to come back, at least this time.
And that must be a bit of a worry for people like you.
Yes, very worried, very.
Que conecta, que hermana, un México creador de puentes. Un país en constante movimiento.
Tourism represents almost 10% of Mexico's GDP and employs around 6 million people. Swine flu is now costing this country at least $100 million a day. The government is understood to be preparing a worldwide campaign to persuade tourists that this country is once again safe to visit. Slow business means the sales pitch by Mexicans looking for a few dollars is more frenetic than ever. Drive down one street in the historic center of the city looking like a foreigner, and you'll be besieged by mariachi musicians. We asked them to play a tune for us.
We haven't seen anyone get this serious flu in Mexico City. It seems to be a normal sort of flu, just like any kind of common cold.
The message from Ismael and all the 100 or so musicians was the same. Come to Mexico,
you'll be fine.
They can come to Mexico. They can come to get to know the country, to enjoy Mexico's music, its folklore, meet the people. We're welcoming them with open arms so they can come and enjoy the best music in the world.
Precautions against the swine flu virus have caused the collapse of part of this country's economy and left many Mexicans feeling ostracized. Millions of people here will need persuading that it was all worth it.
The BBC's Stephen Gibbs in Mexico City. This last note on our wrap-up of things swine flu. Boston Talk Radio host Jay Severin will be off the air again today. Severin was suspended by radio station WTKK last week after making offensive remarks about illegal Mexican immigrants in the context of the swine flu. Severin called Mexicans some of the world's lowest of primitives, leeches, and criminalians. He also said one of Mexico's leading exports is women with mustaches and venereal disease, that Mexicans do not vaccinate their kids, don't speak English, and retard American schools, and that hospital emergency rooms had become condos for Mexicans. No word when or whether Severin will return to his primetime slot. Tomorrow on Here and Now, military analyst Andrew Bacevich. Back after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Another newspaper teeters on the brink. Management of the Boston Globe and the paper's largest union failed to reach a deal today after an all-night negotiating session. The New York Times Company, which owns the Globe, had set a May 1st deadline for the unions to make $20 million in concessions, saying if they didn't get those cuts, they'd shut down the 137-year-old paper, a threat the unions called bullying. In the last few months, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer switched to a web-only publication. The Rocky Mountain News in Denver closed, and the Tribune Company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. So for the latest on the Globe negotiations, we turn to Here Now's Kurt Nickisch. Kurt, management struck tentative deals with unions representing the mailers, the pressmen, and the drivers, totaling about $10 million in cuts. So what did those unions agree to?
Well, they agreed to giving up pay, giving up benefits, total $10 million, as you said. And they also agreed to give up lifetime job guarantees. This means that at some of these unions, some people had basically contracts for life. You can be fired for cause, but you can't be laid off. So they made some pretty significant concessions. The head of the Pressmen's Union, this is the union that sort of does all the press work and the, you know, the machinery and so on, Martin Callahan, he said that they looked at what management was asking for and basically realized it had to be done.
I would characterize it as, unfortunately, a necessary evil. It's the economic times, it's the newspaper industry in general, and the Boston Globe in particular.
Well, we'll talk more about that, the Boston Globe in particular, but first, that does leave the Newspaper Guild as the one holdout. The main sticking point?
Is those lifetime job guarantees.
Yeah.
They have come up also with $10 million just for that union, exactly what management had asked for, but they don't want to give up these lifetime job guarantees.
So to be clear, the Newspaper Guild has come up with the additional $10 million, 10 from the other unions and 10 from the Newspaper Guild. That adds up to the $20 million that the Times management was asking for, but it's that one concession that now seems to be the sticking point in the negotiations. Why is that concession so important to management?
Well, it's because $20 million doesn't add up to $85 million, which is what the Globe is supposed to lose this year. Last year, they lost $50 million. So management needs more flexibility. Lifetime job contracts don't give management flexibility. It means there are a bunch of people who are untouchables, and so they have to cut places where they may not necessarily want to cut.
Well, the management said it would file papers notifying the state that it would close the Globe plants within 60 days if management didn't get the concessions they were looking for. They did get the concessions from the many other unions we mentioned, didn't get the concession from the Newspaper Guild. And after those talks broke down this morning, management said they actually were going to not file with the state just yet. So perhaps it was a negotiating tactic. There's no way to know. But what do Globe workers think about the seriousness of this?
There are certainly a lot of workers who think, give up these concessions, give up the lifetime job contracts because we need to save the Globe. Others, of course, and many of those who have those lifetime job guarantees say, you know, New York Times management, when they bought the paper, they bought into these contracts. They made a promise. They need to live up to it.
Well, I'm noticing, too, that the unions that made the concession, pressmen, the drivers, the mailers, or more of the blue-collar workers. It seems as if it's the newspaper guild, the white-collar workers, holding management's feet to the fire.
They're also the biggest union, so they have the most to lose, money-wise, and the number of jobs that are affected by these lifetime contracts.
And why has this recession hit the Globe harder than other newspapers?
The bigger you are, the farther you fall. The newspaper industry has been hit hard. Boston Globe is a big newspaper. They're losing money, and they have big costs. The other reason is that they were also very successful at their online version, which drove, ironically, a lot of people away from subscriptions to online, which doesn't make as much money.
Right, and we've talked about that before in the program. People around the world, across the country, read the Boston Globe online, but the paper hasn't quite figured out how to make money off of that model. Well, what's next in the negotiating?
It's really down to this last union, the Boston Newspaper Guild and New York Times Company Management. They say they're going to meet in the next day or so to continue negotiations.
Well, now also, Kurt, does the Newspaper Guild have a PR problem? Not many people get lifetime job guarantees.
I think definitely if you look at comments on websites and you listen to people, they think, I don't have that. You know, why? Why should they, especially at a time like this?
Here now is Kurt Nikisch, reporting on the crisis at the Boston Globe. Kurt, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, still to come today, music to soothe, well, maybe even a newspaper worker. Music from Julian Lage. Back in a bit, Here and Now. The founder of the online classified service Craigslist spoke yesterday in Minnesota at a memorial concert for the young woman who was murdered in 2007 after responding to a phony babysitting ad on Craigslist. The family of Catherine Olson says they don't blame Craigslist for her death. Craigslist founder Craig Newmark said that it was devastating to see the way the site is used by bad people to take cruel advantage of others, adding the most recent crime in Boston has been a grim reminder of that. Well, he's referring to the case of Boston University medical student Philip Markoff, who's charged with the murder of a woman he met through her erotic services ad on Craigslist. Should Craigslist be blamed or held accountable for crimes facilitated by the online site? Or is it actually positioned to partner with law enforcement in fighting crime? We're going to speak with the state attorney general in a moment. But first, how many crimes are there? Patrick Black operates the Craig's Crime List, a blog that tracks alleged crime on Craigslist. Patrick, here are some recent headlines from your blog. Pair arrested in Craigslist iPod theft. That's in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Unlicensed contractors caught on Craigslist. That's in Florida. How many crimes do you track a week, and what are the most common?
I would say it runs roughly about 10 a week. And the most common would be prostitution and internet scams.
Well, you know what CEO Jim Buckmaster says. These crimes are a very small proportion of the site's activity. You know, between 40 and 50 million people use Craigslist every month. Why do you think it's important for you to post these crimes?
8 or 9 murders have been facilitated through Craigslist. I think 8 or 9 murders is enough that really warrants attention from law enforcement.
We should say alleged murders.
Yes.
And on their website, Craigslist says that the erotic services category was created at the request of Craigslist users who didn't want to see these ads for escort services or adult webcams in other areas of the website. And they also say that, you know, they walk a fine line of not wanting to trample on people's free speech. What do you say to that?
I respect their right to the First Amendment, but there's also an amount of corporate responsibility that I think Craigslist owes their users. Through the fact they have such an open forum for prostitution, it's allowing an increase in these kind of crimes.
That's Patrick Black. He operates Craig's Crime List, a blog that he says tracks the crimes that occur through Craigslist. Patrick, thank you.
Thank you.
And Patrick Black also says that Craigslist should require people to create profiles with their names in order to use the site. But Craigslist argues that the site is community moderated, that users can flag illegal activity, that users agree in the website's terms and conditions not to solicit prostitution. But admitting that software is now enabling users to get around those terms, Craigslist now says it will provide information to state attorneys general about users engaging in or facilitating criminal activity. It's part of a settlement that Craigslist reached last year with 40 attorneys general across the country, agreeing to work with them and also donate proceeds from erotic ads to charity. Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley joins us. You did not sign that agreement. Why?
Well, it was not so much that we were reluctant to sign on. We just determined that because we would benefit from the agreement and it would apply theoretically to Massachusetts, we felt we would also maintain our option in the event that we had to go further in enforcement on some of these issues. In other words, once you start to deal with Craigslist, are you then limited by the terms of that agreement?
Well, Cook County, Illinois, Sheriff Tom Dart, who filed a lawsuit against Craigslist, says it's, you know, an enabler, and so it shouldn't be congratulated for helping law enforcement. It would be like standing in town square and gathering dope dealers to turn in another dope dealer. But the funny thing is, that does happen, doesn't it?
It does, and every elected official, particularly those of us who are prosecutors, get faced with making sometimes what seems to the public to be like compromises. That's part of the process of understanding how do we advance the ball of public safety without disadvantaging our negotiation or our enforcement authority. And so I don't see it as a downside. I think it was a good first step to begin to talk with Craigslist about some of the concerns of sex for hire and other illegal activity that occurs on Craigslist.
Well, and how does that work? You know, I mean, you're walking a thin line of, you know, freedom of speech and illegality, and it's sort of been, you know, ever thus. You know, we here in the Boston area, we have the Boston Phoenix, for instance. I'll just pick one paper out of the air. Page after page after page of erotic ads. So what is legal and what is illegal?
Well, it is illegal to, for instance, engage in sex for hire in Massachusetts, as it is in most states. What does get murky is around this First Amendment piece and the advertising piece. And, of course, if law enforcement in Boston wanted to spend 1,000% of its time on tracking down every one of those ads, we could do that. But we don't. We choose to focus our resources on the cases where we feel there's the largest effect on public safety. If you think about Craigslist as a big bulletin board in the dorm, ordinarily, you know, the people in the college don't look at that bulletin board unless something bad happens. And so I think some of the incidents that have occurred as a result of people using Craigslist have drawn law enforcement attention. I know, for instance, when I was district attorney, we were quite concerned in the last 10 or 15 years that Craigslist was one of the main ways that pimps would seek out to young girls who were runaways to engage them in youthful prostitution. But Craigslist was also a way for us to get at those people who were engaging in that crime.
One of the reasons that you can is that Craigslist has made an agreement to require strippers and escort services to pay a fee with a credit card to post the ads, and that credit card at least leaves you a trail.
Well, that is part of the agreement, and to be honest, I can't say, for instance, that they've been enforcing the terms of that agreement, and my guess is that many of the people who use Craigslist don't want to identify themselves as engaging in illegal activity and probably don't comply with those terms.
Well, and by the way, how are you able to digitally track messages back to users' computers? I mean, that is another advantage that you didn't have back when people were slipping in and out of payphones.
Yes. Some of that does involve working with the service providers, the people who hold those ISP addresses. And we've had a variety of efforts, either through federal process or state process, to try and get that information. One of the things that is new about this is that digital evidence is not something that's taught in most police academies. We've undertaken in the AG's office to try and do the education of police across the Commonwealth around digital evidence. For instance, how do we do an examination of a computer? Just as we need medical examiners to do an autopsy when someone's killed, when we seize a computer, we need the technical experts who can do essentially an autopsy on that computer.
This is your cybercrime initiative. In 2007, you unveiled the Massachusetts Strategic Plan for Cybercrime, and we understand it's trained 2,000 state and local law enforcement personnel on how to do the kinds of things you were talking about.
Yes, and we are developing a state-of-the-art laboratory so that we have our own experts but also can train the experts around the state. You know, there are very few crimes that happen now where digital evidence isn't involved. A violation of a restraining order and domestic violence on a cell phone. People really engage in both legal and illegal activities. A lot of it is done online with digital devices, and police need to be up to speed on that.
By the way, Craigslist is protected from liability when it posts ads for the illegal activity we were talking about. Because of the 1996 Federal Communications Act, they get immunity just for posting content. But do you think that that should be?
That is the question of the day. And obviously, some of those answers have to be made at the federal level. There is this question about, if it is illegal to begin with, is it okay to advertise it? And it gets very tricky in terms of what we allow for First Amendment and what we allow the government, what we want the government to do. And so we've had this sort of uneasy relationship with an organization like Craigslist that says, yes, we know you can do it. We don't like that you do it. We want you to help us when we come to you, which they have done so far. But we have not been able to really say you can't do it. And so we sort of acknowledge, like many parts of, we have never been able to stamp out illegal gambling or to stamp out, you know, illegal sex for hire. And there's some sense that we will do what we can to protect the most vulnerable victims, but we don't stop a lot of consenting adults from engaging in behavior. We just can't put our resources to it.
Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley. Martha, General Coakley, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No problem. I'm happy to do it.
It's Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Boston-based Julian Lage has been playing the guitar for 16 years, was on 2 Grammy-nominated jazz recordings, and has just released his debut album, Sounding Point. And he's 21. This song, fittingly, is called All Purpose Beginning. A composer as well as a guitarist, Julian fronts his own ensemble on his new CD and on stage shows, where he looks like the happiest young man in the world. And Julian Lage joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You do have this sort of permanent, and I mean this in a good way, goofy smile.
Well, how about that?
Have people told you that?
People have expressed that they, you know, it's very clear that we enjoy what we're doing. And it kind of emanates throughout the whole group, I think.
But you do have the biggest smile. I just want to listen a little more to that song, All Purpose Beginning.
Yeah.
What's the sound that we're hearing around your guitar playing?
Oh, that's pencil writing on paper, actually. It's based on the idea of someone writing a letter, actually, a letter I was writing to a friend. And I thought it had a very evocative sound. It could be a love letter, could be an angry letter, could be anything you want.
It's what our show sounds like a lot, because I doodle.
Yeah, it's a very humanistic kind of touch.
There you go, there you go. Well, we heard that you picked up the guitar at 5. You grew up in the Bay Area of California.
Right. That's right.
What propelled you?
Well, there was a guitar in the house. My dad played, and at the core of it, I just wanted to do what my dad was doing. I asked for a guitar when I was 4, and my parents said when I was 5, if I was still adamant about it, they'd gladly get me one. And I think I just loved the way it felt, the way it looked, the way it, just the way it was and the way it sounded. And that's kind of what drew me to it.
You were a prodigy of some sorts when you were young. I'll say it because it's hard for you to say. And in fact, there was a film made about you.
Jewels at 8.
Jewels
at
8.
Yeah.
What was that about?
Well, it was a thesis project by a director named Mark Becker. I just happened to be the subject, but it really wasn't about, it wasn't intended to promote me or my music or anything. It was kind of a day in the life of a 7, 8-year-old student, I guess, you know.
Prodigy,
Well, and it wasn't as much that, you know, in retrospect, when I see it, it wasn't about how gifted I could be perceived as. It was more, here's me going to school and dealing with friends and this and that, and then here's me going to a rehearsal with a group of adults. And I think what you take away from it, or at least what I do, is that there's still a person there. You know, and the Prodigy label was always very, you know, people were trying to be nice, but it was I never felt it was very fitting for me. And I think the movie captures that.
He's currently dividing his time between second grade and the Conservatory of Music at San Francisco. Ladies and gentlemen, Julian Lage.
Is there any part of you that wishes that you had those childhood years back? And, gee, I could have picked up the guitar at, you know, 15 and probably still been as good.
I can't think that
no,
way.
No.
I think that's maybe more an outside perspective on it, but I wouldn't trade anything. No.
And you played blues and classical, and why that? Right. Was that, again, your dad's music?
Well, blues was more or less my dad's music. He listened, both my parents, both my mom and my dad. Then the classical side was around, and some of the jazz was too, and I think I just kind of picked up whatever I could.
But you ultimately, you know, switched to jazz, but when you went to Berkeley just recently, you studied classical music.
Yeah, I was pretty focused on classical composition. I've been kind of the student throughout my life where I would just find, you know, every book about composition I could, every book about orchestration, and just study it and kind of nerd out about it.
So did you picture yourself, you know, and maybe you do still, as, you know, the next Osvaldo Golahov or John Adams or a modern classical composer?
Well, I'd love to be in a field where I could collaborate with them and take on projects that are kind of in that realm of larger works. Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, in the meantime, let's hear a little more of what's on your CD, Sounding Point. This is one of your solo improvisations, Familiar Posture. Now, we hear this was inspired by Alfred Hitchcock.
That's right. We did 10 recordings of solo guitar, and the theme was Hitchcock Preludes, and I guess what that meant to me, at least, was that we're trying to achieve some kind of suspense by using themes from the rest of the record.
So foreshadowing there, a la Hitchcock.
That's right.
Who are your guitarists? Who are you emulating when it comes to the guitar?
I think there are characteristics about certain people, especially Jim Hall. I was always a huge Jim Hall fan. People like Charlie Christian or Django Reinhardt. I mean, that's in the jazz world. I think Julian Bream is probably my favorite guitar player. So, yeah, I think I'm drawn to characteristics about everybody.
Well, and the everybodies are, you know, starting to pick up on you. You're playing with them. And let's listen to one of three pieces on the CD where you're joined by banjoist Bella Fleck and mandolin player Chris Thiele, both Grammy winners, you know, big-time musicians. Let's listen to The Informant.
The way those guys work is incredible. I mean, they're so musically gifted and they're such hard workers. I think I drew a lot of inspiration from that for the rest of the record, because we recorded that first and then went back a month later with my band.
Yeah.
And the rest.
Well, I want to refer back to where we began, which is this big, goofy smile that you have on your face now. I thought it was just, and it's wonderful, and I thought it was, you know, maybe one of those raptures that we hear musicians get, you know, when you're playing. It's sort of, you know, you look like Stevie Wonder, you know, so happy when you're playing. But now I'm seeing that it's maybe not the playing, it's what?
I think there's a positive energy that's kind of around a lot of the things I involve myself with, and it's hard not to be influenced in some positive way by it.
That's the guitarist Julian Lage, 21 years old. His new CD is Sounding Point. Let's go out with, what should we hear, Clarity maybe?
Yeah, Clarity. That'd be great. That'd be great.
Which he seems to have a lot of. Julian, thank you.
Thank you so much. Great talking to you. Thank you.